What's up? Welcome to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. I am Jamie Dodd, my co-host, of course, also covering the team for The Athletic. He is Thomas Drantz. Canucks Talk brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Let Kubota do your heavy lifting. Visit them online at DLEAMC.com. We are live from the mobile Kintec studio at Rogers Arena. Kintec, Canada's favorite orthotics provider. Powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet, what are you waiting for? 650, 650, of course, is the Dunbar Lumber text line. And Drantzer, we are here at Rogers Arena. The Canucks are still practicing as we speak on the ice below us. A final tune-up day for them before they get going in their regular season tomorrow against Calgary. But the North American segment of the NHL regular season gets going today in about 90 minutes here. Hockey is here. Regular season hockey, not in Prague. Here in North America is happening today. It's very exciting.
Not in Prague. It'll. Yeah.
Well, I'm trying to hype it up. It's like, is it the Canucks' first game? No. Is it the first game of any sort? Well, also, no. First game in North America.
I just like the idea that it's a kind of opening day for the league, except the regular season is already in progress.
Yes, exactly. Very well put. So, yeah. But still exciting. It feels
for sure.
Those ones were like, they're fake.
You don't want to check my work?
No, I do not.
No, I want this to stop.
No,
thank you.
Whatever. Those ones felt like halfway between preseason and regular season. You know what I mean? Where it's like, I guess they're kind of real.
Well,
these ones feel real.
And it's also hard with the takeaways, right? It's like the Buffalo Sabres top line got demolished. They struggled to score, right? Like, you know, I think there's a sense already around the league that, like, game three must win for a Buffalo team that otherwise will feel like, you know, here we go again, mm-hmm. in a market that, you know, I think much like Vancouver can snowball quickly, right? Not Vancouver now. I think if the Canucks lost the first. Well, if the Canucks lost to Calgary to open the season and then lost to Philadelphia again, would there be panic?
I don't think so. Panic, but it would be a spicy inbox on Monday morning, I'll tell you that much.
Yeah, I mean, I honestly think it's the Calgary one. Like, losing to Philly, whatever, that team, you know, everyone knows what Tortorella, early season Tortorella teams can
do.
But
losing both.
You think people would be mad?
Yes. 100%.
Tears.
Maybe not panic.
Tears in their Thanksgiving gravy?
Yes, absolutely. 100%.
I don't know. I think people know with a decent degree of confidence this time around. I don't think it's going to be like when they lost to Philly last time and talk, it was like, who are we to have any right to think we're somebody, right?
Yeah.
And fans were like, oh, here we go again. There was a real different sensation. It's why that game in Florida, their fourth game of the year, was so important, right? And it's mm-hmm. why, like, and this is sort of an interesting thing too. It was after that Florida game, because not even during that Florida game where the Canucks really found their identity that we saw the rest of the season. It was really the Nashville game that followed it, mm-hmm. right? Like, game five of the regular season, we began to see, like, oh, this team's going to back check really hard and squeeze really aggressively at the blue line and manage the puck really conservatively, and they can control games. And then they came back, and it was like that, you know, Rangers game, the Jets win, like, early in the season. And then after that Nashville game, we could see what this team was, or at least we could see signs. We didn't know how much to put stock in it, but it was clear that they were playing good hockey. That's sort of an interesting part of the regular season, is like teams find a groove at various different points or carve out an identity that lasts. It can happen in November. It can happen in December. Great teams are often 500 after 20 and then, you know, top of the standings by a mile by the new year. So, you know, there's so much that we're going to learn. I don't think we should overreact either way to two games, or even if the Canucks were to, you know, pull a Sabres out the gate.
To be clear, I'm not saying there should be panic if they lose the first two games.
See, I don't think there will be. I just think there's a different, like, quiet, earned confidence around this team this year relative to where we were last season.
I think there should be. And I've been on the radio going back to September saying, like, I'm not worried about the start. I'm not worried if they have a little bit of a slow start out of the gate. I've got some pushback on that. I don't know why we're starting with this, but I'm curious
it's fun.
Now. I will throw this at you. How many games in a row do you think they would have to lose to start the season before panic set in?
Oh.
Because I think it's the first two.
No, I don't think so. Well, so let me be clear, though. I think it obviously depends. If the Canucks come out and they're playing hockey that looks demonstrably Canucks, but in consecutive order, both Shelovs and Lankinen got lit up.
Yeah.
In games like you know, I'm talking like those games where your team is outplays the opponent,
yep,
but the goaltending
giving
shaky,
up back-breaking goals, and yeah.
I think if that happened, then people would be very concerned, and I would say that's the only scenario in which they probably should be, because as much as I think we're pretty confident that this is a playoff-caliber team at least entering this season, I do think it's fair to be like, but what about in goal?
See, I don't know. If they go, let's say they play Calgary and Philly, and the defensive game, like the changes to how Rick Tocchet wants to play just aren't showing up, right? Like, they're giving up more off the rush, but they're not generating enough to compensate it for. If it doesn't look like last year, I think there's going to be a lot of people who are very, very concerned all of a sudden, right? Again, I'm not endorsing that point of view. I'm not saying it should be cause for panic or anything like that. I agree. I think this team has the talent to withstand a little bit of a slow start out of the gate, but I know this market also, and I know this fan base, and there's going to be a whole bunch of panic there. Dalvier says, I'm lucky enough to be going to both the Calgary and Philly games, so I'll personally be a little annoyed if they lose both. That's acceptable, Dalvier.
Absolutely.
It would certainly be annoying if you're going to both of those games to see them lose both. All right, Landon Ferraro is going to join us at 1 o'clock. Lots to get into today. As I said, the Canucks still practicing here at Rogers Arena ahead of their home opener tomorrow night against Calgary. Let's get right into the whiteboard.
All right, now, fellas. Hey, let's focus up, huh?
It is your daily deep dive into what's up with the Canucks for today, October 8th. The headlines, as mentioned, Canucks practicing right now at Rogers Arena. Their final tune-up before they face the Calgary Flames in game 1 of 82 tomorrow night at Rogers Arena. From what I was observing before we got on the air, pretty high energy, lots of hooting and hollering from ice level transfer from the players. I'm sure there is a lot of excitement to get this underway for them. We'll get into more of this in the lineup notes section of the whiteboard, but worth noting here just quickly that both Connor Garland and Pius Suter, full participants in practice today. And one of the things we were promoting or teasing on our show yesterday was that Patrick Alvin was going to speak to the media. He did that at 2:30 yesterday afternoon. Also went on Canucks Central with Dan Riccio and Satyar Shah on Sportsnet 650 later yesterday afternoon. And, you know, Alvin, as he often is, pretty playing things pretty close to the vest, but did share some interesting information, you know, talked about the conversation he had with Archdeep Baines and just how difficult that decision was to make as Archdeep Baines came on strong towards the end of preseason. And especially, you know, he referenced that final preseason game against basically a full Edmonton Oilers lineup and how comfortable Baines looked in that spot. And really what stood out to me, a couple things. One, just the insistence that they're going to be taking their time with Thatcher Demko. That stood out to me. And then also the...
Oh, not just the insistence that they're going to take their time, but that they have to for his long-term health.
Yeah.
Like, that was a quote that really piqued my interest, right? That really got my attention, because in some ways it lived outside the realm of managing a player return, right? It was a framing Demko's injury status as something of a bigger deal in some ways than sort of how we've talked about it or discussed it for the most part, right? Like, you know, at this point, we have the luxury of having Kevin Lankinen and Artur Shelov's here, so we don't feel the need to rush Thatcher. I think that's important for his long-term health. For me, that comment casts this in a very different light than some of the, you know, indefinite return, we'll take it slow. Mm-hmm. Like, to me, that was more procedural, whereas this suggests, I think, if you're reading between the lines, this suggests that, hey, like, there's a long-term health consideration here too that, you know, really might mean that we're looking at a longer timeline than perhaps we'd envisioned even when we were first discussing the prospect of Demko missing both training camp and the preseason, you know, a month ago.
See, I also see it, though, as just part of what I think should be obvious now, which is that Demko's health is a season-long project even after he gets back, right? Like, and I think that's how I interpreted that quote, is that there, it's not as if, like, I didn't interpret it as, you know, long-term concern for him, like, after hockey or anything like that, right? Like, you sometimes hear people talk about injuries that could impact somebody's quality of life after their playing days are done. But to me, it was more about, we want to get him back, but we also want to make sure he's in a position to perform at the top of his game when he is back and for a long time after that, right? And it's specifically going into the playoffs. So to me, it's all part of that. It's, they're going to take their time getting him to return as part of the plan to put him in a position to succeed come the playoffs, right? Like that's how I fundamentally interpret it, which I think will mean, one, that they're going to really take their time before he actually plays a game. And then even once he does start playing games, you know, we've talked about them carrying three goalies. They're really, I would expect them to really manage the workload in terms of games played, in terms of practice, all of that. And I think that's what Alvin was getting at there, at least in my interpretation, was this is going to be something we're focused on and we're managing for this whole season, at least for this whole season, and maybe even going beyond with Thatcher Demko.
Oh, man. Yeah, well, and there's huge implications to that, you know, from a workload perspective. I mean, yep. I keep hitting these boxes. This is my new checklist, right? But it's, you know, the various arenas or buckets of uncertainty that we now have with Demko, yep. Right? The timeline's one. When do we see him back? Then when we see him back, what sort of workload is he capable of safely handling?
Yep.
What sort of performance dip is attached to this injury, if any, right? Because we focus on this a lot with, like, ACLs, MCLs, but we have real examples. You know, like, I can point to four or five guys who've come back from the injury and various player types. Like, with the ACL that Mikheyev, you know, sustained, we could say, like, Anders Lee and Evgeny Malkin came back and were effective right away, but they're also giant backboards who, you know, are able to just score from in tight and don't need to rely on speed. Faster players seem to have a longer shelf, a longer runway to get back ramped up. We don't have that. We don't have that when it comes to a popliteus injury.
Nope.
We've never seen it. No one has. So what sort of performance dip might be associated with the injury? And then lastly, what sort of re-injury risk? Which, again, we have no basis for comparison on.
Mm-hmm.
All of which really, I think, casts Canucks goaltending in a, you know, like, it's not negative, it's just we don't know what to expect.
It's uncertain.
Yeah, and to sort of add to it, Artur Shelovs has played 18 games in the NHL between the playoffs and regular season. His career save percentage at the National Hockey League level is sub 900. His American League counting stats, save percentage wise, have been pretty pedestrian, to say the least. And then you get into Kevin Lankinen, who at least he has an NHL track record, but also, you know, an average track record over 100 games. Talkett has often cited this club's defensive form as, you know, a sort of a reason for meaningful optimism. But, you know, that only takes you so far if you're giving up the laughers, if you're giving up those sorts of goals that cause a team to slump.
Yeah.
So, again, goaltending to me, this team's goaltending situation, I think they should have enough bullets. Alvin talked about being confident in Lankinen and Shelovs holding it down. I think that's fair. I'm not saying he's wrong. I'm not picking against them. But it is a deeply volatile position to begin with, and the Canucks have a particularly volatile situation.
Yep.
So if it goes poorly or if it goes really well,
I
will be equally unsurprised.
That's why I think uncertain is really the way to look at it, or volatile instead of negative, right?
Yes.
Because there absolutely is a world where goaltending is a huge thorn in their side all season, right? And maybe a fatal thorn in their side ultimately for their ambitions. And I don't want to say – I always feel like I'm, you know, sounding a little Pollyannish when I bring it, but I do think there's an upside too, which is like Lankinen and Shelovs perform really well, do more than hold down the fort in a 50-50 share. Demko is able to take his time. You know, the injury rehab goes really well, and all of a sudden you've got Thatcher Demko, who has played way less than a normal workhorse starter's workload going into the playoffs, and it's a lot fresher. Again, and I can't tell you what percent likelihood that has or whether it's more likely than the extreme negative outcomes, but I think that's an outcome that is 100% in play. And again, it just seems like there's, from that end of the spectrum to the more negative end of the spectrum, I really have a hard time handicapping where we're going to land. But I know there's a whole range of some really good outcomes and some not so good outcomes, and then obviously a whole bunch just in the middle here as well. But, I mean, I don't think anybody can really guess at what exactly we're going to see in the crease from the Canucks this year.
the upside case, I guarantee you, is seen pretty prominently by a top executive who runs the Canucks and Jim Rutherford, who won the Cup in 06 with a backup goaltender who'd played 28 games that season and was 21 years old, replaced Martin Gerber over the course of the season. Gerber, by the way, got Vezina votes. He was 11th in Vezina balloting that season. So, like, not a like the clearly established guy, right? Cam Ward was, yeah, literally 21 that season. And then in Pittsburgh, both of those Cups came with Matt Murray as the starter, replacing Marc-Andre Fleury, a Hall of Fame-bound starter who'd previously won a Cup for the organization. Like, if anyone is going to have a sense that, hey, this young, untested guy might be young and untested, but also might just be really good, it's going to be Rutherford, right? Like, there, people see patterns. People see recurrent patterns through life. That's sort of one of the advantages of experience. And, you know, I think that's part of the paradigm that this club is entering the season with. On Joshua, by the way, it sounded far more positive skating. Yep. We actually just saw him. He came out by the bench and was watching and guffawing with his teammates as practice went on. Had a lengthy conversation with Rick Tocchet. Seems to be around the team. Seems to be well, which is great to see. And
Alvin says he's been skating in the morning before the normal team practices.
Sometimes with Demko. So seems like we're getting a little closer on that. Feels like at this point there is a bit of a separation, right, between Demko and Joshua. It feels to me reading between the lines of Alvin's commentary and sort of how it's trending vibes wise between the two. It just feels like we're going to see Joshua back on the ice a little bit before Demko, maybe a lot before Demko.
I think that would be very surprising if it goes the other way at this point. Anything else that stood out to you from Patrick Alvin doing the media rounds yesterday?
No, not really. Just the, he wouldn't commit to keeping three goaltenders, but I think that's the plan. I don't just think that's the plan. That is plan A. That's not to say that plans don't change, but that's how the club is thinking about it. I really think there's a benefit to keeping three goaltenders. I actually wonder if we see that become more commonplace going forward. I think there's real rest advantages. There's real weapons to it. And I'm just reminded, Jeff Sullivan, who now works for the Houston Astros but was a phenomenal baseball writer at Fangraphs, used to say, if you want five major league caliber starters, then you better have seven on the roster because you're going to have concurrent injuries over the course of a 162-game season. Well, if you want to have two NHL goaltenders to choose from, you better have three or four, but especially three if you're going to constantly choosing between two NHL level options. We live in a world now, like 10 years ago, and granted the league's expanded by two teams here, but 10 years ago, you know, you'd see like 74, 73 goaltenders every year play five or more games.
Yeah.
These days it's, you know, mid 80s, 85, 86, 87, like a level of bloat that it can't be simply explained by expansion. And I think what we're coming up against is with post-integration techniques, with the, you know, quality of shooters, with how teams exploit goaltenders moving east-west, like, I think goaltending is more physically demanding than it's ever been.
Yeah.
As a result, like, I mean, we've seen the 60-game-a-year starter sort of go the way of the dodo anyway, or certainly the 70-games-a-year starter is no longer a thing at all. An extinct beast. But I wonder if we get to a world where, like, really, if you're a team with cup aspirations, you want to go 50, you want another guy who can play 20 to 30,
yeah,
and you want another guy who can play 15. And like, I think that's how this Canucks team should be building it, especially with everything that surrounds Demko. I've kind of been agitating for this for a few years, but you want the most rested goaltender heading into the playoffs. Like, those benefits accrue as you get into late May and June. That's where this franchise's eyes are trained, as they should be. And, you know, in some ways, I wonder if they've stumbled on a way, you know, because this isn't plan A. This
is
a reaction But I wonder if they've actually stumbled into a situation that could be more optimal than, you know, the way they've managed it under three consecutive coaches, really overutilizing Thatcher Demko year after year.
Yeah, and again, that remains the upside case here, right? Is if this forces a workload that keeps him fresher now, and there's a lot that can change or can disrupt that plan, but there is some upside potentially down the road here. To the lineup notes, of course, from Canucks practice, one thing before we get into the lines, Mark Friedman placed on waivers today at 11, and this is an interesting one because, of course, once they made the Tucker Poolman deal, they didn't have to expose on roster cutdown day any of Neil Zaman, Noah Juulsen, or Mark Friedman to waivers. Interesting timing here, right? The day after everyone has done all the hard decisions and made all the cuts and every team in the NHL has set their roster, and then you place a guy on waivers, and it feels like a pretty calculated move to maximize the chances that Mark Friedman ends up clearing waivers and going down to Abbotsford. And so the timing, I can understand. Is the desire to send him down simply a matter of, hey, we're going to start trying to accrue that cap space as aggressively as we can here? What's the logic behind the decision to send Mark Friedman down?
Well, the timing of it is fascinating, right? Every team has worked all summer to get to a point of compliance. They've set their opening day playing lineup yesterday, right, by the deadline. All of their cap space, for the most part, is accounted for.
Yep.
All of the LTI captures are just so, exactly the way the team wants them. And boom, the Canucks wave Mark Friedman. So every other team is excited for the season, happy with their roster.
Yep. They've gone and had press conferences about how much they love their roster. Like, hey, this defenseman made it. We love that. We're so excited for him.
Moves are made.
Yeah.
Right? The table has been set. Right? The guests are about to arrive. And all of a sudden, the Canucks have been like, we're going to sneak this guy through waivers at the worst possible moment for you to strongly consider a claim on them. I think this does speak to the regard the organization has for Mark Friedman. They'd love to keep him, even if it would result in them having, $3 million in salary on the Abbotsford blue line. I mean, it's an expensive blue line with 4 one-way contracts. Brännström, Akito Hirose, Guillaume Brisebois. I mean, those three don't factor into this team's NHL plans. Brännström could maybe change that equation with a really strong performance, although, man, Alvin's commentary about the club considering Brännström this offseason was
pretty lukewarm.
Cutting, I would say. Point being, that's an expensive American League blue line, but boy, would it ever be nice to have a true NHL-level contributor, which Friedman unquestionably is, down at the American League level, right, where, if you need them over the course of the year, they can come back. That said, Friedman was waived by the Penguins last offseason and ended up being dealt, right? So, this is a guy who's been in the NHL for most of the last few years but still lives in that sort of precarious zone on the fringes of the 23-man roster, as well built as he is to make those decisions as difficult as possible for NHL teams. I'm sure it's a tough day. I guarantee it. And I guarantee you, no player goes on waivers and doesn't want to be claimed if they're an NHL player.
Of course.
So,
yep.
We'll sort of see how this unfolds. It's not as simple as that, but I do think the club has timed it with the idea of keeping him front and center, and they've timed that well. It is going to be difficult for teams to submit a claim.
In terms of how they lined up today at practice, as I mentioned, Connor Garland back with the team after missing both the practices over this weekend. Pew Suter continues to be a regular participant as well, as was Connor Garland. So with that in mind, the top six stays the same. Danton Heinen with JT Miller and Brock Besser. Elias Pettersson between Jake DeBrusk and Daniel Sprong. Pew Suter centers Nils Höglander and Connor Garland on the third line. Neil Zaman with Teddy Bluger and Kiefer Sherwood on the fourth line, which means Atu Ratu is the extra as of right now. And then on the blue line, the familiar pairings, Hughes Roenick, Susie Myers, Forbort Desharnais, Noah Juulsen, the extra. So reaction to Atu Ratu getting bumped and Pew Suter taking over that third line spot.
I mean, look, we'll see. Let's just sort of see exactly how this unfolds. This isn't morning skate on Wednesday morning, but, this club likes Neil Zaman. Perhaps they're not ready to bump Pew Suter out from the center ice position. I thought it was notable yesterday that Tockett had a comment about how Pew Suter can play wing or center after spending much of the early part of training camp discussing Pew Suter solely as a center. I would say that's progress from Atu Ratu's standpoint, even if he's not in game one. And let's remember not to overreact to a game one lineup, right? If Ratu deserves to be in, those opportunities are coming. You're not getting through an 82-game season without scoring slumps, injuries, and other considerations forcing Tockett to juggle his lines. Whether if the Canucks decide to defer to the experience on their roster and have Ratu wait another day, so be it. It's not like he's about to make his NHL debut. He's played 15 NHL games. Yeah. Like, you know, we'll sort of see how it goes. But I do think with Ratu, right, you've got a player who's on sort of two or who's sort of on two tracks, right? He can potentially be a fourth-line center. He can potentially be a third-line center. The club's probably going to be reluctant to play him on the wing. And, in fact, if they were going to do that, it would be more likely to bump Pugh Suter, I think, to the Amon spot. Mm-hmm. With Ratu playing third line center. I mean, that's not a fourth line wing spot we're talking about. That's a signature high leverage premium position in the top nine that is Ratu's path to getting into this lineup most likely. That is a high bar to clear. So I'm not surprised by any means, but I also wouldn't read too much into it necessarily. Just because he's not there game one doesn't mean he won't be there quickly.
Yeah, and I would say the fact that they kept him up means to me they're going to look for opportunities to get him in, right? Like, I don't think it's going to take an injury or someone playing really poorly or something like that, right, for him to get in. I don't think the plan is, okay, go sit in the press box for, you know, 2-3 weeks. I think they're going to be proactive about trying him to get him those opportunities, you know, as much as plans sometimes change in the NHL.
I just want to note, too, there's Nikita Zadorov.
Yes.
Hilarious, right? Appeared on the podcast, the Boston-based podcast. I've done it before. They're awesome guys. Pete Blackburn's
right? Yeah.
And, so What Chaos is the name of the podcast. And was asked if he wanted to stay in Vancouver, and he said, we wanted to stay at the start. We tried to sort it out, but there's a point in negotiations when you check boxes. And a couple things didn't go the way we wanted it to. He noted that it felt a little bit disrespectful. Now, we covered these negotiations mm-hmm. and the club's stance throughout ad nauseum, right? This club drove a pretty hard bargain with all their free agents. You know, you look at every contract, basically, that the Canucks agreed to, and maybe you could say, hey, you know, I wish they'd saved a year on Tyler Myers. Yep. But, like, the Dakota Joshua deal was almost immediately out of date, right? Like, it was so team-friendly that by the time Yakov Trenin, yes, a far inferior player, signed, it was like, wow, what a wild conclusion that was. If you're going to like the outcomes of a team's contract work, you're probably going to have some angry outgoing players, mm-hmm. just as a general rule. Zadorov, congratulations to him. It's a great contract. It's a great fit for him in Boston. I think he's going to be beloved there by Bruins fans, sick as that makes all Canucks fans to hear. But, you know, not a surprise that the Canucks were playing hardball. That shows in the contract work that they did almost across the board, where, like, the only deal you'd even say, like, oh, I wish they'd kept it a year shorter, was one in which the player cut his salary by half.
Yeah.
I mean,
even
it's
Teddy,
just what it is.
Teddy Blueger didn't get a raise. He had a really good year for them. And I was like, yeah, same deal.
He set a career high in points and played top nine for them almost all year.
Didn't get a raise.
Right. So, you know, the realities of the hard cap are that you kind of have to play hardball with players. I think where it sort of gets a little more interesting is not how Zadorov feels about it necessarily, but, you know, is there a chance, especially given that they're going to try him on the top pair to start the year, is there a chance that, you know, we do look back on that and be like, man, what a unique piece. The Canucks really should have kept him. Because even just saying it, usually you get the safe answer, you know?
Yeah.
Zadorov's not, you know, pussyfooting around. Zadorov's coming out and saying it. And I think that's part of what made him so well-liked in this market, and I think it's part of what makes him so cool, just like generally, as a human being and player.
That's the whiteboard for today.